A quorum.
There we go.
Okay, let's roll. All right, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the CVAG Energy Environmental Resources Committee meeting for Thursday, September 15th of 2022. We obviously are on a virtual mode here, but welcome all public comments and have accessibility towards that. With that, let's please go ahead and call the meeting to order, and we'll start with roll call.
Thank you, Chair. Agua Caliente, Band of Queens, City of Blythe, City of Cathedral City.
Present.
City of Coachella.
Present.
Coachella Valley Water District. City of Desert Hot Springs.
Present.
Imperial Irrigation District.
Present.
City of Indian Wells. City of Indio.
Present.
City of La Quinta.
Linda Evans, present.
Mission Springs Water District.
Nancy Wright, present.
City of Palm Desert.
Here.
City of Palm Springs. City of
present.
Just in time. City of Rancho Mirage and Riverside County.
Here.
Chair, you have a quorum.
Excellent. Okay, let's move right into public comments on agenda items. Do we have any requests to speak? I didn't see any pre-notes, but any hands raised, we'll keep an eye out.
Chair, we received no written comments and we have no hands raised at this time.
Terrific, thank you. Any committee member or director comments before we move into our consent and action items? Let's go ahead and start with
Linda. I have a couple of comments real quick.
Sure.
At some point on this committee, I would like to discuss the infrastructure that we have to meet the governor's goals of going to all electric cars 2035 and the infrastructure needed to combat the drought as well at some point.
Okay, so my guess would be that since we don't have agenda items for those, but clearly a desire to discuss them, so let's see what kind of time we have post Salt and Sea, but I'm thinking maybe we put that on as discussion items for a future meeting. We have a little bit of time on that.
Thank you.
Okay, and I do see Russ Betts' hand up.
Yeah, I wanted to follow on to that suggestion that it be a future agenda item. Basically, where's the electricity coming from? And is hydrogen a better solution? There's this big rush, everybody knows, to go to electric cars by 2035. But the big question is, where's the energy coming from? Southern California Association of Governments Transportation Committee is getting ready to take that up as well. So it might be timely for us to consider that question also.
I'd love
to see that as an agenda item.
Okay, Tom, duly noted on those. Supervisor.
Thank you both, Russell and Gina, for bringing that forward. That's obviously a discussion that has been ongoing for us here. And as far as the county is concerned, we've been tossing around the idea of what would it mean, what would it look like for a regional approach, meaning Coachella Valley-wide approach to future energy needs, and then how do we meet the demands of making sure that we reduce greenhouse gas emissions and dealing with climate change and things of that nature. So I definitely welcome that conversation, and as well would like to, once we have a date for that, have county staff engaged. That way we can think through very thoroughly the bigger picture, meaning not only this area, but then they're probably going to be thinking around countywide as a whole. But nonetheless, so obviously I'm thinking about the 4th District. With that being said, just very quickly on another note, on October 5th, just want to give folks a heads up that is California Clean Air Day. It's a statewide event, and I think there's close to 400 organizations involved in participating on that day. And as a matter of fact, my understanding City of Palm Springs, City of Cathedral City, I think, and Manuel Martinez representing CVAG is also engaged. I'm happened to be the co-chair this year with Michelle Decker from the Indian Empire Community Foundation. And I'll be presenting, for example, at our next meeting, a proclamation indicating October 5th as Clean Air Day, and your own jurisdiction can do something similar or have some sort of event to raise awareness about October 5th and raise awareness about ultimately improving air quality and the environment as a whole. So just wanted to bring that to your attention and thank you for your indulgence.
Very good. And I would like to call upon our executive director to introduce Kenyon Potter, who I had the pleasure of meeting during the interview process. I'm happy to have him part of the team.
Yeah, this is the bring friend to work day. It's really bring somebody into the office so that I don't have to do as much work day. And Kenyon Potter is our director of the Department of Energy and Sustainability. And he's the one that's going to have to figure out how to address things like an agenda item about energy and meeting the governor's demands and what do we do in the Coachella Valley. So he'll be tasked with that and you'll see much more of him in the future. Kenyon, you want to introduce yourself to the committee?
Sure, nice to meet you all. I love the Coachella Valley and I spent a number of years here. So I'm back at home. I'm an engineer by training and I'll put that to good use. I also have other experience in energy and sustainability. So I'm glad to be here. Nice to meet you all.
And I will say that we had some, we should put some of these questions we did during the interview process towards some of the elected sometimes and see how they manage them. Quite thoughtful in his responses and clearly a broad sense of experience that will challenge each of us in a skillful and knowledgeable way. So welcome aboard. I see two hands. I see Oscar and I see Russ Martin. So let's go with Oscar first and then Russ.
Thank you, Mayor Evans. In our September meeting for the SCAG Energy and Environment Commission, mm-hmm. we passed the SCAG Water Action Resolution. And so during the presentation, we learned a few facts about the drought. 2001 and 2002 brought the second driest two-year period since statewide recording began in 1895. 98% of California is currently in drought. More than 44% of the state is in the most extreme condition of drought, known as exceptional drought. And the Department of Interior has declared the first ever water shortage declaration for the Colorado River Basin. Also, 60% of the state's water use is currently coming from groundwater, and that's up from 40% in normal conditions. A few of the proposed directions. Just some examples are encouraging planning for infill development and multifamily housing projects, which shows lower per capita water usage, supporting implementation of green infrastructure and gray water usage and urban cooling infrastructure, holding an industry forum to gather national expertise on investments in sustainable water infrastructure, and aligning investments in water infrastructure with the adopted growth forecast and development pattern. Two other updates that I have is I was recently appointed to the SCAG Resilience and Conservation Subcommittee by SCAG President and Mayor of Palm Desert, Jan Harnick, and we'll be starting those meetings next Monday. Another update, I organized the Coachella Valley Water Seminar earlier this month at COD's Palm Desert campus, and we had some great speakers there, including Secretary Crowfoot from the California Natural Resources Agency, Assemblymember Eduardo Garcia, and Chair of the State Water Board, Joaquin Esquivel. And we also had some great presentations from CVWD, the Board of Food and Agriculture for California, and the Salton Sea Management Plan. And that's all I have for today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that update, Oscar. And Russ Martin?
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that it wasn't clear to me during roll call whether or not Supervisor Hewitt is given credit for having a representative present, myself, and I just want to make sure that the record reflected that. Thank you.
Excellent. Okay, thank you. And then Tom, let's go back to you before we move on to consent.
Yeah, just a minor thing on the agenda, but we got a email from the hardworking Deborah McGarry at 2:30 in the morning this morning, who pointed out that we did not put a pamphlet at the end of the staff report for item 7E that we referenced in the staff report for item 7E. So if you printed out or looked at your agenda packet a day ago, you wouldn't have seen the pamphlet or the flyer. If you look at it today or right now, you will see the flyer. So thank you, Deborah.
Thank you, Deborah. Excellent. Okay. Any more committee member or comments from our director and new staff member? All right. Seeing none, let's go ahead and move on. We've got item number five is the consent calendar and meeting minutes and the tire amnesty program. And I know that Tom can probably chime in a bit on our plans for our, we've got a couple different tire amnesty programs where we get money to do those, but questions on that, or we can do a motion second and then discussion if you'd like. Anybody interested?
Madam Chair, are you making a motion to approve?
I just said that yes, that consent, yes.
I'll make that motion.
Thank you. Desert Hot Springs moves.
I'll second the motion.
Okay, Palm Desert seconds. Tom, if you want to just give a brief update on B and perhaps the direction moving forward.
Yeah, we run these used oil and tire recycling programs every year, and you see a little bit of administrative details every year. They're relatively small grant programs with a little bit of paperwork with the state of California. In the future, we intend on consolidating them and having an RFP that goes out for both of those programs. We think there are contractors out there that can do both at the same time, and that could save the taxpayers some money or perhaps even broaden the program. So just a heads up, you'll hear more about that in the future.
Great. Okay, we do have a motion and second. Without any further discussion, all those in favor, please say aye. Wiggle your fingers. Aye.
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 Any opposition or abstentions? Seeing none, that motion passes unanimously. Section six is our discussion action section. And the first one is a brief presentation from the overview of the 2022 Air Quality Management Plan. And Sarah Reese is here from ACAQMD.
Good afternoon, everybody. So yeah, I'm going to give you an update of where we are on our air quality management plan, the one in 2022.
To interrupt, but I just was going to make a quick comment, and I really appreciate you jumping in.
I do too.
Very quickly, and apologize, okay. Mayor. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Manuel Martinez. I just wanted to preface this presentation and the one after it with a couple of comments. One is that the next two items are air quality staff reports having to do with the one with ozone and then the next one with PM10. So I just wanted to make that distinction and differentiate so we are all on the same page. And then secondly, I just for those of you that may not know, our Riverside County Supervisor Perez is our representative on South Coast AQMD, and so we appreciate his efforts that he does on behalf of the Coachella Valley. So I just wanted to preface these next two staff reports by differentiating between this and the next report and just acknowledging Supervisor Perez with that. And with us today, we have Sarah Reese, our technical expert, who is going to take it away. Go ahead, Sarah.
Thank you very much. I'm the Deputy Executive Officer for Planning and Rules and Implementation at South Coast AQMD. A big part of my role is developing these air quality management plans. And so today I'm going to talk to you about where we are with our 2022 plan. Next slide, please. So an air quality management plan is the blueprint or roadmap as to how we're going to be able to meet federal air quality standards in both South Coast Air Basin and the Coachella Valley. There are multiple air quality standards, and so there's multiple plans in place. The last plan we did was in 2016, and that plan addressed multiple criteria air pollutants. This particular plan is focused only on ozone. This is really about getting to the most recent ozone standard, which is the 2015 ozone standard. It's also the most stringent ozone standard, and so it presents quite a challenge for us to be able to meet it in terms of the amount of emission reductions we need. I have our website up here. You can click on that link and be able to access all the materials that are associated with this draft plan. Next slide, please. Probably not news to anybody in this meeting, but we've suffered from some of the worst air quality in the country. We're the worst by far for ozone. We're the second worst for fine particulate matter, depending on the year. Ozone levels are a little better in the Coachella Valley than they are in the South Coast Air Basin, which has pretty epically high levels of ozone. We've made a lot of progress. It's not all bad news. We've certainly slashed emissions by over 50% over the last several decades, which is a huge accomplishment. But there's still a lot of work we need to do to be able to meet federal standards. Next slide, please. This is another good news, bad news story in showing how the concentrations of ozone have declined over the years, and we've made a lot of progress. The blue line is South Coast Air Basin levels. The red line is in Coachella Valley. But you can see starting in about 2014, at least in the South Coast Air Basin, the reductions we've been getting have leveled off and in fact gone up a little bit. In Coachella, it's not as bad. It's going down still. And we do expect that in the Coachella Valley will be able to attain the standards much sooner than in the South Coast Air Basin. The horizontal dashed lines, those show the level of the standards. So that shows you where we are in terms of concentration regarding those standards. The reason for that uptick in the South Coast Air Basin, we believe, is due to meteorology. You guys probably noticed we've had a lot of long, hot, dry summers with a lot of stagnant air. Those are the perfect conditions for ozone formation. But based on our modeling, we know that if we continue our strategies to reduce emissions, ultimately we'll be able to get improvements in ozone levels. Next slide, please. There are important health impacts associated with ozone, mostly respiratory impacts. So if you have asthma, it'll make asthma worse. You know, if on a high ozone day, often if people are outside, they can even feel a little burning in the lungs. So a lot of inflammation and damage, you know, sore throats, and then aggravation of existing conditions. Fine particulate matter also causes health impacts. The big one there is it's very strongly associated with increased premature death and other serious impacts, including cardiovascular disease and cardiopulmonary disease. Next slide, please. So this is showing the need. NOx is really the key that we need to reduce in order to meet ozone levels. Ozone is formed in the atmosphere. It's the reaction of NOx and VOCs. And in our region, NOx drives that reaction. NOx is formed when you burn stuff. So if you burn fuels for engines or other forms of combustion, that forms NOx. We have a lot of engines in our region, and so a lot of NOx is being formed. And what we see here is in 2018, which is our baseline year, NOx levels are at 351 tons per day. If we do nothing else, just implement the rules we currently have on books, we'll get down to 184 tons per day. So that's great. That's great progress. But unfortunately, our modeling shows that in 2037, which is the date by which we need to meet that 2015 ozone standard, we have to get down to 60 tons per day. So we still have like another 124 tons to go. So that requires really aggressive action on our part. Next slide, please. We look at where the NOx is coming from. It's coming from the mobile sources. Over 80% of the NOx in our region is from mobile sources. And by that, I mean the cars, but it's really the heavy duty stuff. It's the trucks, it's the ships, it's the aircraft, it's locomotives, and it's construction equipment. In fact, you know, ships and aircraft are huge sources of NOx in our region, and they're going to be growing over time. So that's a gigantic challenge for us as a local air agency. You know, our authority is strongest over stationary and area-wide sources. So those traditional type power plants, factories, refineries that people often associate with air pollution, they're actually a relatively small sliver of the pie. We really need to be able to get emission reductions from those mobile sources. Next slide, please. And in terms of who controls those sources, a lot of those sources are subject to federal authority. So as a local air agency, again, our authority is over those stationary sources where we, you know, we have permits in place and rules in place to control those emissions. But CARB has some authority over those mobile sources. And then the ones that are growing, the ships, the aircraft, locomotives to some extent, those are subject to federal authority. So we really need the federal government to start weighing in and taking action to be able to help us meet federal ozone standards. You know, I've said it before and I'll say it again, I could shut down every single stationary source in our region and it still wouldn't be enough to meet those federal standards. We absolutely have to have action from the federal government. Next slide, please. And so in our plan, when we look at where the emission reductions are coming from to get down to that 60 tons, in the light blue, that's South Coast AQMD's contribution at 32 tons. That's reflective of the fact that, you know, what we control are the stationary sources, and it's not really the lion's share of these emissions, but we are still getting reductions from those guys. CARB is also working with us. They're getting some emission reductions on trucks and some other mobile sources where they can. They have a special measure that they're looking at on locomotives, but we're looking at 51 tons needs to come from federal government. So that's a lot of contribution from those federal sources. Next slide, please. Given all of that, we really need some innovative approaches in this plan to get down to those level of emissions. It's no longer looking at end of pipe controls. You really have to look at fuel switching, changing and transitioning to zero emission technologies where possible. Where not, looking at the cleanest possible technologies in place. That's really challenging. And in the next few slides, I'll go through that. So next slide. That's a quick overview of our strategy, focusing on NOx control because NOx is really what we need to reduce. We do know that other programs are focused on greenhouse gas reductions and there's some co-benefits associated with that. There are some areas where we're looking at reductions on VOCs because in the short term that can help us as well. And then some miscellaneous other measures. Next slide, please. So the kinds of things we're looking at, it's really on focusing on combustion, both residential, commercial, and then also industrial combustion, because I mentioned before, NOx is formed when you burn things. So on the residential side, looking at appliances, looking at space heating, looking at other types of combustion, and where there's either fuel pumps or other types of technology that could be used that are very clean or zero emissions. On commercial side, again, looking at water, space, heating, cooking, and others just at the commercial scale. And then at the industrial side, there's boilers, there's process heaters, there's some combustion processes and refineries, looking to see what those cleanest technologies are. In a lot of those cases, zero emission technology is not feasible because it doesn't result in high enough temperatures, for example, or for certain types of process emissions, there's just no way you can get to a zero emission approach. So we're just looking across all these areas and see where we can be as clean as possible. Next slide, please. There are some mobile source measures we're looking at. We do have some limited authority. And so we are looking at what we call facility-based measures. So these are sources that don't emit much by themselves, but they attract a lot of mobile sources. So a classic example is a warehouse, and we already have a warehouse rule on our books that we're implementing right now. We're looking at developing a similar rule for marine ports, as well as for rail yards to try to reduce emissions associated with the ships and the trains. We're also looking at some possibilities on reducing emissions growth from new and redevelopment. And so clean construction standards, for example, to help there. And then we're also looking at some pretty innovative approaches. So on ships, we're looking at some collaborations with China and other Pacific Rim countries, where perhaps we can have some joint incentive programs in place to attract cleaner ships to visit our ports, which would then benefit everybody who have these ships calling on them. Next slide, please. We developed this rule, a full public process. So there's multiple stakeholder meetings that we have. We have an advisory group. We have working group meetings, public workshops. There'll be regional public workshops in October where we'll be presenting. And then also taking written comment. Right now we have the second version of our draft out for comments, and that comment period closes in mid-October. And then getting input from different state agencies and federal agencies, because we all need to work together to be able to get this to work. Next slide, please. In terms of our development, we are planning to get a final draft to our board for a review and approval by December 2nd, so December board meeting. Again, I mentioned that I'll be giving an update this upcoming board meeting in October on what the status is, and we'll be doing our regional public hearings in October. Next slide, please. And this is just showing the information for our public hearings. You note that we're doing a hearing in the Coachella Valley on October 18th. Next slide, please. So if you're interested, stay informed. You can sign up and get information about the AQMP emailed to you and given to you on a regular basis. Next slide, please. And I believe that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Yes, we do have questions. Let's start with Gina from Palm Desert.
Hi, thank you. Sarah, question. When you refer to that it's going to be a challenge to reach our goals on our own by 2037, you said we're going to need the federal government. Can you give me an example or two of how the federal government can help?
Yeah. So one thing they're working on right now, so I'll give you an example on heavy duty trucks. So CARB has some authority on trucks and they have a number of rules in place to clean up the trucks. But CARB's authority can only really touch those trucks that are registered in California. And a lot of the trucks come from out of state. And so we need federal rules on trucks. and need them to be really clean. EPA right now is in the process of developing a rule. It's the first time in over 20 years that they've been doing this, and so it's long overdue, but they are right now in the process of developing a rule on trucks that will help. It'll help, but it won't get us there. Even EPA's most stringent version of that rule won't get us into attainment by 2037. It still has our ozone way above federal standards. So they need to take action on ships. We need them to figure out what they can do to clean up the ships. And they haven't really ever done a rule on the ships. We need them to figure out what they're going to do on aircraft. Those two sectors alone, both ships and aircraft, they would take up all of the NOx that we can have in the atmosphere if we're going to attain the standard by 2037. So that means you would have to zero everything else out if no other action is taken on those two sectors. So that's the kind of leadership we need the federal government to do for us.
Thank you.
Okay, and Supervisor.
So I'll tell you, out of all the committees that I sit on, and you all know as elected officials, we sit on so many different committees. This one here, I think, is probably one of the most difficult committees to understand, to adjust to, just because of the technical aspect of it all. And even though I've been on this committee, let's just say maybe a few years now, I'm finally getting some grasp of it all. And it's just so many moving parts. And so that's a great question you just raised, Gina. What is the role of the federal government in helping us reach these standards? Now, what I find difficult to understand is, and I'm gonna ask Sarah to elaborate on this, what happens if we do not meet these standards? What potentially can happen to our funding streams when it comes to, for example, transportation dollars that comes from the federal government, although the federal government is the entity that should be guiding us, supporting us to reach these standards. It's basically on them at the end of the day, because we're doing what we can as AQMD when it comes to stationary sources. And there's a difference there between, like, for example, a manufacturing plant or a peaker plant, like the one we have in Desert Hot Springs, a stationary source, something that doesn't move. And CARB is doing what they can when it comes to mobile sources, meaning, for example, diesel trucks. Maybe they also deal with vessels, I'm not sure. But the federal government deals with large airplanes, definitely the large vessels that are coming from China. And so I, long story short, Sarah, although knowing that the federal government plays a role in all this, they should be helping us. What happens if we don't meet those, standards by 2037?
Yeah. So it's a very good question you raised, Supervisor Perez. There are hard consequences under the Clean Air Act for failure to meet the standards. And it's a little bit of a nuance. It's not about failure to meet the standards. It's basically failure to do everything that's in your plan. The plan is a legal requirement of and show how we're going to get to where we need to be. Our plan has a big chunk in it that we rely on the federal government because we say, hey, these are federal sources and we can't get there without you guys. So if the elements in the plan aren't executed, and you don't meet the standard, then that triggers economic sanctions and a federal implementation plan. What that means is that we could lose our federal highway funding, which is in the nature of billions of dollars for our region. We could lose, we get, it makes it harder to permit new sources. Those sources have to pay substantial additional fees. So there's a very big economic impact in our region. And then the federal government comes in and takes over air quality planning. So that's when they start step up and they start looking at some pretty draconian measures like no drive days or maybe having a cap on emissions at our ports. So there's some very hard consequences that we need to work to try to avoid that. We are in talks with the federal government, with EPA and with our congressional delegation to raise awareness and make it really clear that even though 2037 is 15 years away, we need people to step up now so that we can get those emission reductions by that time and not be in such a bind.
So thank you for that, Sarah. And let me just one last just other point, Madam Chair and colleagues, just kind of just follow along here, because it's, like I mentioned, it's a lot of moving parts. So here in the Coachella Valley, you started, Sarah, by indicating that our pollution here is not as bad per se as it is in the rest of the air basin, meaning, for example, Torrance, LA, that whole area out there. We do have an issue with dust. Mm-hmm. That's big. That's not NOx though.
Yeah, but it's big. Yeah.
But it's big. However, what we do have an issue with is the pollution that's coming downstream.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. From
the rest of the basin. Now, even though we as a Coachella Valley wide region group of leaders do everything we can here to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and to reduce NOx, the truth of the matter is, to a huge degree, it's outside of our control.
Correct.
Because it's flowing in from other areas, such as far out as Long Beach and LA. And so my question, Sarah, is what else can we do? Not necessarily here in our region, but I don't know, what else can we do to further support the efforts of South Coast Air Quality Management District when it comes to the other areas that really need to reduce NOx so that it doesn't transition and flow downstream here to the Coachella Valley?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Supervisor Perez. I'm like, I would even go as far as say, I don't believe there would be an ozone problem in Coachella Valley if you weren't getting all of the emissions from the South Coast Air Basin. It's both the ozone that we generate in South Coast going over the Banning Pass and heading into Coachella Valley, as well as the precursor emissions. So just the NOx emissions. And they then have their time where they cook in that desert sun and then create ozone. So it's really all focused on those, what we can do to reduce emissions in the South Coast Air Basin, because that's where all the activity is happening. It's you know, there's very limited sources in the Coachella Valley. You know, there's some traffic, but the lion's share of all the emissions are coming from South Coast.
Yeah. So with all that being said, colleagues, obviously we just need to be mindful of doing as much as we possibly can, although I support CV Rail, right? We need to understand that we will receive some NOx from CV Rail, although I support it. As you drive up the 60 freeway and you go up to 10, you're beginning to see these huge distribution centers, mm-hmm. right? And from those distribution centers, you also have quite a bit of big scale diesel trucks. And there is an effort to bring in distribution centers here into the Coachella Valley, not only in our cities, but as well as in the county, right? And so we just have to try to strike that balance. And, you know, we want economic development. We want to create jobs, but we also want to preserve the public health of our communities as much as possible, right? And what is that balance? And that's a whole other conversation. But thank you for your indulgence. I just wanted to make sure that I kind of walked you through some of this stuff. It's a big monster.
Thank you, Supervisor. Dennis in Palm Springs?
Gina, I want to thank you very much for your question. It was my question, Supervisor Perez, right on point. I totally am with you on that. I thank you that hopefully the CV Rail will reduce automobile emissions, mobile emissions, and there'll be a trade-off. Sarah, great answers. And thank you for your succinctness in that and your directness. You had mentioned, Sarah, that the ships were regulated by the federal government, but yet AQMD was working to offer incentives, I believe it was, for ships to be clean. And I assume not every ship has to be, it's just whether they want to take your incentive or not. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so, you know, in the Coachella Valley, you know, we have the major airport is PSP, and both the takeoff and landing is over residential areas. And We've seen, and there's a huge push because of tourism as the economic driver in the Coachella Valley to push that airport to its limits. And even we're having just mechanical issues with just getting everyone through there, not to mention NOx issues or air pollution. Are there ways that you would recommend that we can incentivize our airport to run more efficient planes, or because it's a federal government regulation, not a local regulation on that, or what might you suggest that we could do?
Planes are really touchy because there's levels of federal preemption where the federal law kind of rides in and bars that. And then also because of safety issues, that there's a lot of discretion given to pilots. So for example, one thing planes could do to run cleaner is single engine taxiing, where they only have one engine running when they're taxiing, but that's completely up to the pilot's discretion. We are unable to require that. Even the federal government cannot require that because it's you know, the pilot is the person who has the best, you know, feel for safety. So we've been working with the five major airports in the South Coast region. Palm Springs is not part of this yet, but we've been working with them on voluntary agreements for where they can have control, get to the cleanest equipment possible. And so we have a memorandum of understanding each with LAX, John Wayne, Ontario, Long Beach, and Burbank. And we're working on that now. And that's where they come in with the cleanest ground handling equipment possible, the cargo handling equipment, you know, all of the shuttles that are associated with the airports, et cetera. But getting cleaner planes is really tough. And the other piece of that is that the federal government has regulations in place. Recently, they've done on aircraft, but they're for greenhouse gas emissions. And the actions that they take to reduce greenhouse gas emissions basically make the engines more fuel efficient and burn hotter. And that actually increases NOx. So it's been really challenging for us.
Wow. Okay, Nancy, and then Russell Betts.
I don't want to appear to be just single focused, but I'm kind of curious if you have any statistics as to, you know, let's say our homes and our businesses, what percentage of these businesses and residences have solar, are maximizing their solar? That's not going to work everywhere, but certainly in the Coachella Valley. I have solar. I have an electric car. I can charge it for $10, you know, and I don't use any gas. And I'm not saying that I'm, you know, some poster child for what everybody should do. But the idea is that it's going to really offset its cost over time. So it's not, even if there were grants or loans available, you know, to do those things, how much more solar can we have next to what we have now?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know that there's huge pushes from a climate perspective to increase solar. From a NOx perspective, we don't necessarily always see the reductions that you would expect from solar deployments, but it is something that, you know, we are working with CARB and coordinating. I don't have exact statistics. I agree with you. Coachella Valley seems like an ideal place to be able to push more solar. And certainly when you have it integrated with having an electric car and battery storage, that's great. Like that's sort of optimizing everything. But yeah, I don't have those statistics.
And I'm not thinking about it just, you know, for air conditioning. I'm also thinking for large vehicles.
Oh yeah.
And that might take, you know, bigger facilities and more panels, or I'm sure as we evolve, there'll be smaller panels and get, you know, just as much energy, but I don't want to pass that by in our future. We need more solar. Yeah. It will help with our vehicles.
I think it also goes to a comment that was raised earlier about infrastructure and where all the electrons are going to come from. I'm like thinking through that. It's not just about the grid itself, but when you have more solar batteries, even like bigger vehicles that are electric, that changes how you balance out the grid, right? And so thinking through that really comprehensively and how that can help get us to where we need to be to have the sufficient power for all the cleaner technologies that are needed.
Thank you, Sarah.
Russell Betts.
Yeah, thank you. So I think we have to insert into this conversation any economic impacts. We're facing pollution coming from the Inland Empire and the LA Basin, which is impacting us, even though we are not as big a source. And then, you know, you also have that coming in from overseas, China, which is a polluted mess. And we're getting those impacts. And it's like a situation with water conservation in desert hot springs. We are already the model of water conservation. compared to the rest of the valley. But when a standard is set, everybody has to come down 20%, which impacts a lot of this impacts, these economic impacts hurt the low income communities disproportionately. And even on a Coachella Valley wide system or look, we got to make sure that if we're talking about doing things like requiring planes coming into Palm Springs Airport to be special, well, maybe airlines are going to say, you know what, we're not going to fly in there. We can't meet that requirement. And then that has an impact on us. I know the Tourism Bureau is working really hard to bring in flights from different cities. If we go and do these impacts that make it harder to bring those flights in, we're working against ourselves. And the question is, where we're already an example or doing really well, or at least not the major cause of the problem, what percentage of the solution should we be? And to the point that it hurts us economically, we at least need to take a look at that. Again, in a community that's not the wealthiest community in the Coachella Valley or even California, I see what happens with these gasoline prices and how they're impacting low-income residents. They hit really hard. They're devastating. And the same thing can be true here. So I really think that if we're going to take a look at this conversation, must have balance into what the economic impacts are. And I'll just use my last comment to be, you take a look at what happened to Sri Lanka when they went to all 100% organic farming. Just huge famine, total devastation there. You know, great goal. Let's go to this great goal. And it just totally wrecked, you know, their economy, and people are literally going without food now. So we have to have that into the conversation, the economic impacts. We're not going to get to 100% utopia clean air. It just can't happen. Thanks.
Well, quick follow-up to that, and maybe I can address as Supervisor Perez, since he's on that board, is a couple of years ago, they were talking about a ballot initiative to increase taxes to help address the air quality, even though it was predominantly in Southern California, not in the Coachella Valley. That's an impact that I would not want to support in the Coachella Valley. Any status on revisiting that going forward?
Is that a question for me or QMD? That has not been a topic of conversation, not that I'm aware of, Sarah.
To my knowledge, that is not a current issue that we're pursuing.
Good. You said this was a topic of conversation some time ago, Linda. I don't recall.
If I recall, it was either 18 or 20, 2018 or 2020, there was contemplation about the same time, I think maybe it was pre-COVID, that RCTC was looking at putting something on as well. And it was a battle of what we're going to support. And that was about the same time we were getting hit with our ozone levels that were coming from elsewhere. And it was like, why would we want to fund the efforts that they should be doing their job in the LA, Orange County?
Okay. Yeah, you reminded me now. You reminded me now. Yeah, so
nothing new.
Yeah, no, you reminded me now. Nothing new, but you're right. AQMD was considering at that time potential quarter cent, half cent tax to figure out a way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Yep. However, RCTC was very separate from that. That was two.
No, there were going to be two efforts.
Yeah. And then SCAG had theirs, and I mean, there was all, and then we had ours. So, but none of that is having being discussed at this point.
Very good. Well, Sarah, boy, nice presentation. Good discussion. Definitely a needed discussion and ongoing. And you're right. I mean, we make every effort possible, and there's still opportunities for improvement. But it is an example of how you've got to collaborate in all areas, because our pockets of success may help us in a small way, but we've got to have collective success throughout the state for sure.
Thank you guys. And thank you very much for the questions.
Thank you. All right, Emmanuel, we want to move to 6B, our regional PM 10 street sweeping study.
Yeah, hi. This is going to be an update on our regional PM 10 street sweeping study. And I'll just start off by segueing off Supervisors Perez comments that there are a lot of moving pieces to air quality. And here's one moving piece that are street sweepers in the Coachella Valley that contribute to improved air quality and improved quality of life for the residents of the Coachella Valley. With that being said, let me get Let me move on. Oh, I can't click. There it goes. Just wanted to give you a quick visual of what PM10 looks like. Some of you may or may not know, but I thought it was important to have some visual reference of what PM10 is. It's a particle that's 10 microns in diameter. And I just wanted to show this picture here to give you a very clear image how it compares to a fine beach sand particle. And you heard a lot about PM2.5 right now from Sarah. So here you can see exactly what that size is, and here it compares it to a human hair strand. So just wanted to give you a very quick visual how small these particles are and why they can provide a public health risk if they get into our lungs. Here in the Coachella Valley, we are in non-attainment for PM10, and we are currently under a 2003 state implementation plan. And there's a number of measures to improve our air quality here in this region. One of the best available control measures, or BACM, is street sweeping. And we here at CVAG, in coordination and cooperation with all the cities and the county, have been doing this program here regionally. And then just by way of background, and to put a plug for South Coast Air Quality Management District and the role and assistance they play in assisting the Coachella Valley with this particular program, just wanted to again give you some reminder that we did receive a grant from them, a $1.15 million grant for a 5-year period. This grant was split up into two. We did get one contract for the first year to get the program up and running. And the second contract was for the efficiency study and for years 2 through 5 of the funding of the program, we get allocated $220,000 per year. But of course, for years 2 through 5, to unlock that remaining fund of $880,000, we need to complete this efficiency study. And we have some preliminary findings here that we would just like to share with you and give you the highlights on. The study design and the approach included a few major components. One was looking at traffic patterns in the Coachella Valley, monitoring data from our federally regulated air monitors in Palm Springs and Indio, looking at past wind events. We know we have a windy season that begins mid-February through June. And then looking at cost and comparing our program to other similar programs, as well as to the programs that the cities run for their local streets. One of the major things that contributed to ensuring that we are effectively and efficiently addressing PM10 through the street sweeping program was looking at traffic increases. The good news, though, is that our route already covers a lot of these areas where we even have seen traffic increases. However, I do want to point out that we paid particular attention to those areas that had average daily traffic, or ADT, of 10,000 or more, and that was our threshold in terms of having recommendations of new streets, which I would shortly go over, that should be incorporated into the program so we can comprehensively get in-train dust off the road and prevent it from being pulverized by ongoing traffic, and minimize fugitive dust from getting kicked up into the air. So some of the streets that we are recommending: Sunrise Way in Palm Springs, East Mesquite Avenue as well. In Rancho Mirage, two streets, Los Alamos and Duval. These are streets, again, that are in or adjacent to the blow sand area that is primarily along the I-10 freeway. And in Indio La Quinta area, Avenue 50, and Madison Street. So a total of 5 streets that we are recommending into the program for this new contract that we are getting prepared for in 2023. And some other findings, again, in terms of keeping track and data of the effectiveness of the program, is having good data in terms of sand that's getting picked up by the street sweepers, by having those trucks being weighed before they're dumping that sand at disposal sites. In terms of coordination and contract management, having a requirement of GPS tracking in the street sweepers so we can effectively communicate with the cities and the staff leads as to when the sweepers will go by your respective cities. And then ensuring that we use compressed natural gas and low emission fuels in the vehicles, not only for the street sweepers, which are already required to adhere to clean natural gas requirements per AQMD rule 1186, but also sometimes some of the sand is dumped at various sites throughout the valley, and then it's picked up and taken to the disposal site. So in that second process, again, important to use low emission vehicles and fuels. And then just to tell the story from a data standpoint, in terms of the progress that we made, just wanted to point out that since 1993, when the first SIP was adopted in the Coachella Valley to address air quality issues, we have seen a downward trend. So overall, good news in terms of reaching here the in the yellow dotted line, the annual PM10 California air, ambient air quality standard. And here, this box plot, which basically tells you what PM10 looks like on an average day here in the Coachella Valley, going back from 1988 to 2021. You'll see the blue line there indicates when the air quality programs began here at CVAG in the Coachella Valley. We have seen some improvements, and just really want to point your attention to that circle there on the right upper hand side of the graph, which shows that in terms of being below the threshold of the federal ambient air quality standard, we are seeing a decrease, which is good news. And hopefully that trend continues and someday get below that yellow line to be at or below the state standard. Continuing with the just data story, here we see what PM10 concentrations look like in 1991. And just wanna point your attention to those two peaks, big peaks there above that red line that exceed the federal standard. Those again, just point to the windy season that contribute to the PM10 in the air here in the Coachella Valley. You can see from February through about June. And then we see a decline for the rest of the year. But just want you to take pay close attention to this graph compared to the 2021 graph, where we have seen a significant increase, definitely below the federal standard. And I can say near approaching being below the state standard. So we have seen some improvements in terms of implementation programs and the street sweeping program being just one component of the overall comprehensive approach. We have seen a decline. So with that being said, we did incorporate the preliminary study findings into the RFP, which was released late August. So that has been issued. We are going to complete the study and submit that to AQMD. We did consult with them on the study design and approach, which they approved. And actually, that study will be finalized tomorrow. And after that study is finalized, we will come back to you for proper committee approvals. By November 5th, go to the executive committee so we can start a new contract for our street sweeping, regional PM10 street sweeping program. So with that, I do have our eCorp consultants here with me, Seth Myers and William DeWall, and also our CVAG air quality consultant, Dr. Emily Nelson, is on here as well. I appreciate all their help and support in helping me getting this through. And we're available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Emmanuel. We do have questions to start with, Supervisor.
Thank you for the thorough report, Emmanuel. And I'm just wondering, has there been consideration in the past, or to what degree are we measuring the amount of dust PM10 out in the North Shore Mecca thermal area? As well as, for example, sometimes when we get these high winds, how much they impact 1,000 palms, the east end of the 10 freeway, the other side of Bermuda Dunes is known as the Shadow Hills area. Have we thought about those areas as well in the past, or is there any thought for any type of street sweeping if it's necessary and those areas in the future?
Well, to answer your question, this program focuses on the Coachella Valley cities and some parts on the county. So we haven't expanded the approach beyond our city's jurisdictions or boundaries. Nonetheless, during the process of the study, we did come across data on air quality pollution out in that area, right? Particularly deciding as to what monitoring data we were going to use. And of course, because we have to adhere to the federal FACTS, the federal air quality, ambient air quality standard and state, we use those two, which is the one in Palm Springs and Indio. But there are others like iPurple Air that are in that area. I think that would be a discussion for just the broader committee and the group in terms of a discussion. But Tom, I don't know if you want to add.
Yeah, little background on that. The two air quality monitors, the Indio and Palm Springs, are South Coast air quality monitors. We don't do any monitoring directly. And Supervisor, I think you're aware that monitors have been set up, is my understanding, around the Salton Sea. And I believe those are managed by South Coast as well. The monitoring for purposes of EPA and South Coast is very precise. I remember a few years ago, there was a monitor at the Torres Martinez parking lot that they had some issues with because the parking lot wasn't paved and it caused, you know, different levels of pollution at different times during the day that weren't indicative of true air quality. With respect to paving in North Shore, for local streets, we don't do local streets because this program is really focused on those high volume streets pursuant to South Coast. I don't know if the county does street sweeping on the local streets at North Shore, but each of these cities certainly do have their own street sweeping contracts for the local streets. We could explore perhaps, you know, the state highway and maybe see what Caltrans does for Highway 86 and Highway 111.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Let's explore that further, and it may be that there aren't. It may be that potentially there could be funds in the future from AQMD to help support unincorporated areas, or maybe not. But at least, and then it may be that the data indicates that we need such a program, or maybe not. I think we need to explore that further in case I need to do what's necessary at the county level to advance those efforts for those unincorporated areas. And that includes, quite frankly, Thousand Palms, the Bermuda Dunes area, because I also know that out in that area, we get quite a bit of high winds.
Clarify, we are doing street sweeping on major streets in Bermuda Dunes and Thousand Palms.
Just the local. Yeah, it's right. Major arterials, right?
No, I get that. I'm just kind of wondering about even more, a little bit more targeted, but that's a long conversation. Thank you.
Hey, Gina.
Yes, thank you. So Mr. Martinez, question, does this conversation also include leaf blowers?
No, it does not. This is strictly PM10 street sweeping.
Okay, thank you for answering that question.
Sure.
All right, so we're on track then with the study so that we can continue with the proposal, and hopefully we'll get a report back in the next meeting, or at least probably by the November meeting, right, of potential approval, and then implementation goes forward.
That is correct, Mayor Evans.
Excellent. Sure. Okay, very good. All right, anything else on that item? If not, we'll move. I'd like to propose that we skip C for just a moment so we can do our election of the committee officers for the next year, because I know how spirited our discussions get when we talk about the impacts of the Salton Sea and water shortages. So if you would indulge me as chair, at least at this point, to do item D, and I'll turn over to Tom Kirk to facilitate the discussion.
Yeah, it's that time of year again. Annually, you consider your chair and vice chair. Your chair is, of course, Mayor Evans. Your vice chair is Mayor Pro Tem Oscar Ortiz. Let's open up the floor for nominations.
I'd like to nominate Vice Chair Oscar Ortiz for chair.
All right.
I'll second that.
Okay, we have a nomination. And a second, consider that a motion and a second. Any other nominations? Hearing and seeing none, nominations are closed. All in favor of the motion, say aye or wave.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Aye. Seeing none, it's unanimous.
Great.
Do we have nominations for vice chair? Or volunteers?
I'll serve as vice chair if nobody else wants that, since I'm quite familiar with the process, and do the backup need be.
I will make a motion to approve Linda Evans as vice chair.
We have a second.
Second.
Are there any other nominations? Seeing none, it is closed. All in favor, please say aye or wave your hand.
Aye.
Anybody aye. Opposed? Seeing none, it's unanimous. You have switched chairs. congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you.
Congratulations,
and,
Oscar.
This could, Mr. Ortiz, this could take place next meeting. You'll be in charge and we'll be in contact.
Sounds good. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
You bet. All right. Let's go to C then, the update on the Colorado River shortages and potential impacts to the Salton Sea. And we've got Patrick O'Dowd back with us, the executive director of the Salton Sea Authority.
Good afternoon, and thanks for having me back.
You bet.
I appreciate it. I will endeavor to keep my presentation brief because I'm certain that we'll have a lot to talk about. But I'd like to start at the end of my presentation with a brief recognition that on June 14th, the commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation at a hearing of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee indicated that they needed to find 2 to 4 million acre feet of savings on the Colorado River. I happened to be listening in on that and was having conversations with senior representatives of other water districts about what the level of cut might be that they might be recommending. And the discussions at the time, at least amongst the people I was talking to, was in the more of the 1 million to 2 million acre foot range. And so when she said 2 to 4 million acre feet, I think a lot of jaws dropped. That's a lot of water, and there's not a lot of places you can go to find a lot of water. So immediately the Salton Sea Authority staff and its member agency started focusing on what this might mean. I know Director Hanby has a front row seat to these conversations. So that's an important job that he has representing his agency and his stewardship for their resources. So I won't delve into too much the negotiations themselves because those are being handled outside of our scope and purview. But what I will touch on in a bit is the impacts associated with that to the sea and to the region. But I'd like to jump back a little bit. You've got an excellent staff presentation in your board packet. I would direct you to that. There are a couple of things that I would like to highlight just to lay a foundation of some of our talk. Going back to the QSA signing in 2003, I would note that the QSA conversation started in 1998, and it was a 5-year contentious, heavily negotiated and litigated process that ended up in an agreement for the transfer of 200,000 acre feet of water to San Diego County Water Authority. That 200,000 acre feet was realized through a combination of fallowing, not growing, frankly, and on-farm conservation measures. All of those have impacts to the sea, resulting in less water flowing to the sea. And they recognized that at the time, and the member agencies participating in the transfer contributed over $100 million to a mitigation fund. But I think most people at the time were concerned that that was not going to be enough. And the state of California, in order to get the deal done, agreed at that time that they would be responsible for restoring the sea. And I think that was the beginning of one of our biggest challenges and quandaries is what does the state's responsibility mean to restore the sea? For the next part of the QSA transfer also included makeup water to keep the salinity in check in the sea during the 15-year period subsequent to the signing of the QSA to allow the state to develop and implement their plan. So while the salinity was kept largely in check, the shoreline did continue to recede. So the fish were able to survive for a time, but they recognized that the shoreline was running, and IID was concerned that the state was taking no action and filed a suit against them on the transfer resulting in a water board order in 2017 that stipulated certain requirements to the state. The first was a 10-year plan where the state agreed to address 30,000 acres, which they assessed at the time, was representative of about 80% of the then expected impacts of the transfer during that 10-year period. That 30,000 acres was to be comprised of 50,000 acres of habitat and 15,000 acres of habitat and 15,000 acres of dust mitigation. The state started off behind and they continue to be behind as of this date, although they are trying to catch up. The current projects at and around the sea include the North Lake Pilot Demonstration Project, which I spoke on last time I was here. It's a 160-acre lake at the North Shore Yacht Club. We did sign Riverside County as the implementing agency on behalf of the Salton Sea Authority for that project. We did sign recently a contract for the design of that project with DUDEC. We've had considerable conversations with both the state and CVWD regarding source of supply for water. This project was conceived over 2 years ago, and water availability and water quality has become a far more complicated issue in the last 2 years than it was when this conversation first began. But I think we're getting real close to what I believe is a solution that will get this project underway and moving in a direction that will address the impacts or begin to address the impacts in that community. The Desert Shores is a small community lake in Imperial County. There's about a million 250 in Bureau grant funds that were made available for that project. And then there's the large 4,000 acre species conservation habitat project that the state is undertaking in Imperial County, which has about $200+ million in funding. Other projects that are under development right now include the Audubon's Bombay Beach project, which is in the design phase, vegetation re-enhancement work being done on the West Shores, and surface roughening, which is being done to mitigate dust impacts at and around the sea. So that's all part of the 10-year plan. What the order required was a 10-year plan and subsequent 10-year plans. And they required the state to deliver by December of this year a long-range plan in addition to the 10-year mitigation plans. The state has been working on that long-range plan. They looked at both in-basin and seawater importation solutions as part of that evaluation. On the in-basin analysis, they looked at dozens of previous plans that have been advanced over the years. They've had public comments. They've had information from science and public input on that. And they worked up a water supply assessment based on resources that might be available from within the basin, which is really complicated for reasons I'll discuss in a minute. The seawater importation project analysis is being done by an independent review panel. They looked at the previously submitted seawater importation concepts and opened the solicitation to additional plans, but they did terminate that. And right now where they're at is there are three projects that they believe, all three which contemplate importing water from the Sea of Cortez in Mexico, that they believe met the operational requirements to be further evaluated. And right now they're in the process of being evaluated for financial feasibility, and those results are expected shortly. What it didn't address was the projects that may have been considered subsequent to their cutoff. It's a continuing process of people both on both sides of the border that are advancing ideas to address this problem. Let's see. So the state does have an obligation to deliver that long range plan by the end of the year. But as I mentioned at the opening, this curtailment on the Colorado River will almost certainly have an impact to the sea and any projects that we might propose in the future, especially as it relates from in-basin solutions, because the state's work has a range of water availability, but we just don't know what that number is. So that's kind of where we're at on the state's work. What the authority has been doing since 2020 is we've been working at the federal level to secure a United States Army Corps of Engineers feasibility study for the project. It was originally approved to consider the perimeter lake plan, but the feasibility study really is not an analysis of a particular plan. It's an analysis of a problem. And it uses a particular plan as a stalking horse to evaluate a full range of opportunities to address the problem. Because of the work that the state has been doing for the long range plan, it is expected that the state's long range plan, whatever their recommendation may be at the end of the year, will become the baseline by which all other plans will be evaluated by the Corps. We were able to secure the authorization for that in the 2020 WERDA. It's a three-year, $3 million study, but that didn't include the funding for the project. Because it's under the feasibility plan, it requires it's a state and local sponsor joint venture, if you will, and the state pays half of it, and the local sponsor pays the other half. So we've been working with the state over the last year trying to hash out what that local sponsorship looked like. At first, the state was reluctant to even advance the concept of the feasibility study, although if we are successful at finalizing a study, it'll result in a 65% federal match for any project that's developed. But I can tell you that as of the last couple of weeks, we've finalized an agreement both with the state and with the Corps to where they are reviewing what should be final documents, and we're hoping to have a signing ceremony either late November or early December to proceed with this study. And I think that's a pretty big deal. The funding part of it came from the Infrastructure and Jobs Act. The state was able to secure, the federal government was able to secure their $1.5 million match. And the state's match is expected to come from contributed work. They will be a participant as a local sponsor. A lot of the work that they do on the project will be creditable towards the work. Because of the scope and scale and size and issues to be considered and addressed and resolved at the sea, it's expected by everybody that this is probably going to be more than $3 million and probably longer than 3 years. So it's going to be a pretty big deal. But the fact that we're getting it underway, I think, is going to lead to a long-term solution that will bring in the opportunity to access 65% federal dollars from the United States Army Corps of Engineers. So I touched on earlier the shortages on the Colorado River. That when Commissioner Tuton on June 14th announced the $2 to $4 million cuts, there was a deadline set by her as of August 16th, where she said if she didn't do it, the federal government reserved the right to take independent action. Well, when August 16th came, they implemented the existing rules and guidelines. But I'm confident, I know, that those negotiations are continuing. This is a critical situation on the Colorado River. It almost certainly will result in impacts to our region if there are reductions made. And what we are doing as the authority is trying to determine what those impacts might be. When we first heard of the cuts being proposed, we didn't know how much those cuts would be. So we did an analysis in early June of what those numbers might look like. And we came up with an initial assessment that we may be required to come up with 700,000 acre feet of that two to 4 million acre feet of water, assuming, and we don't know what the number is right now. I think that what they're negotiating is a lesser number, but let's assume that the impact is in the range of the QSA transfer of 200,000 acre feet. We know what those impacts look like, at least based on our past experience. The state is doing work to evaluate what they think the additional reductions might be. The problem is twofold. One is we have experience with the state in their work. And the other is the QSA was implemented over 20 years and these impacts will happen over 20 months or a couple of years. So they'll be very quick, they'll be very significant. So we are trying to get our arms around, if the state comes up with a number of what the impacts are going to be, how do we validate those numbers? So we're developing a strategy right now for how to do that. We're working with both the state and the federal government, having conversations about how do we make this a successful endeavor? I believe that every party at the table negotiating this deal is sincerely looking for a responsible and equitable solution. As most know, California has some of the most senior water rights on the Colorado River. So we are, I know that there's a lot of diligence being paid to protecting the citizens of the state of California while at the same time trying to be a good partner in these negotiations. So I'm going to pause there and invite any questions or comments from anybody, and we'll see where this goes.
Very good. Thank you, Patrick. I don't see a hand raised from Desert Hot Springs.
How about that? It's be lunchtime.
Okay, it's okay. Supervisor?
So where do we go from here? I mean, the bottom line now, although I can appreciate, Patrick, what I sense in your voice, some sort of hope. I'm already at a point or getting to a point where, you know, the North Lake pilot project, the project that's being discussed in Desert Shores, is going to be impacted big time. We're not going to have the water necessary. Yeah. And obviously, we're waiting on that study to let us know if the C2C concept makes sense. But the more we go down this route, the more that I hear what's happening with the feds, the more inclined and the more willing I am to accept the fact that we probably got to go to Mexico and go visit some folks. Because it's like we've been here already before and it doesn't seem to get any better. And it feels like we turned a corner and all of a sudden we got a few more to turn. And so I appreciate obviously your thoroughness, your thoughtfulness. You've been in the game longer than me when it comes to the water district. But as far as the politics and the policy, I've been in the game just as long. And it just seems that we're just going in circles. So at what point in time do we decide, for example, the Sanctuary Authority and other entities like the IID already did? And I hate to say this out loud, but sue the state or sue the feds.
So that is part of the work that we are doing right now, Supervisor. I think that this group, the stakeholders of the region, are going to be the ones most impacted by whatever decisions are either made or handed down. Either IID and CVWD are going to agree to a number, or the potential is that the federal government will impute a number. There was in the Inflation Reduction Act, there was $4 billion set aside to facilitate this effort. And it was basketed into three separate categories, and we were actively involved in those negotiations. The first two addressed water conservation and water purchases in order to increase elevation in Lake Mead. But the third basket, and they're not quantified, so it's going to be a bit of a food fight trying to get money into each one of those baskets, is for mitigation. So there is a recognition by the federal government, candidly, thanks to IID's longstanding voice for the sea, that impacts to the sea will have to be addressed as part of this deal. And I know that in my discussions with other representatives on the Colorado River, they are getting it now like they never have. They should have addressed it years, if not decades ago, but right now they're in pretty bad shape and they need a good partner. And I think that it would be unreasonable, in my opinion, for us to pursue a deal that leaves us worse off at the end of the day than we are at the beginning of the day. I think we should expect that what we leave our children and our grandchildren is something better than what we have right now. And I think that everybody involved in these conversations has that same passion.
Patrick, I want to pause a minute again. We've got Russell Betts, Nancy Ross, and also Chuck Parker with comments. So, Russell, let's start with you.
Yeah, I'll just be brief. If I'm one of the residents in the vicinity of the Salton Sea where all the toxic air is, dust is blowing in, and my children are breathing that, my question on every plan that presented is, when is that air quality problem going to be solved? How many years down the road? Will it be my children, my grandchildren that are still breathing this? And the other comment I have is, we keep hearing evaluate, study, same story, but we don't hear any plan. I've reached out to the Army Corps of Engineers. They said as soon as we settle in on what we want to do, they certainly have the capability to bring the seawater in and fill up the sea and solve the problem. I just don't understand why the city's resolution to do an engineering, the engineering that's needed so that we have something in our hands. Hold on a second, sorry. So that we have the engineering, the plan in our hands that we can go fund, why we can't get to that point. I saw 5 years ago, the presentation in Rancho Mirage City Council Chambers, three engineering companies that said they can do it. We're just studying and evaluating and we're getting nowhere, is my opinion. I'm sorry to be harsh, but.
No, I think that's fair. I think that the Corps being involved in this feasibility study, they will consider all options. And I fully expect that seawater importation will be part of that conversation. And I think the federal government through the federal family, the State Department, the Department of Transportation, and all of the federal family partners would be necessary in any type of project of that nature. And the Corps can certainly build big things. So I expect that concept will be given great voice as part of the Corps' work.
And I'll temper my comments a little bit here to say I'm encouraged to hear, you know, the discussion of, you know, we're now talking about the possibility of actually bringing the seawater in and that we've starting to make some progress on that. But I'll wait to hear from Chuck Parker. Maybe he'll tell me I'm all wet. Thanks.
Thank you. Nancy and then Chuck. You're muted.
Russell, we can't afford the water to get you wet. So I think our commission has talked about water import, and that is the side we have fallen on. It is not just for the residents of the Salton Sea, although they are the ones that are really suffering greatly. Let's just say greatly. I was going to say something a little saucier. And I respect our honorable neighbors to the south to even have this conversation with us about importing water from their nation. But it isn't just the Salton Sea. How long will it be before it's our drinking water that is in a crisis state? We're going to have to talk about, you know, large quantities of water desalinization at some point. And I'm not talking tomorrow or next week or next month, but, you know, government, we need to talk about what we need in 20 years today. And so I also support importation, and I hope that it isn't just something they'll consider, but something they'll get their boots on and get busy on. Thank you.
Okay, Oscar, before we move to you, let's go to Chuck Parker, since he's been waiting, and let's get you unmuted first, Chuck. Okay, go ahead. Let's see if we can hear you.
Hi, thank you everyone for giving me this chance to make a brief comment. I also am a member of the Long Range Planning Committee, and I want to let everyone know that the final report from the independent review panel on ocean water import will be presented at a meeting on September 30th from 5:30 to 7:30, and I can email the members of the committee a copy of that poster. I'm very happy to, I mean, it's not a happy situation where we don't have enough water, but it seems as if it's becoming clear to more people that we've waited so long, now the situation has deteriorated, and really the only viable way to disconnect the Salton Sea from the Colorado River would be to import water from the Sea of Cortez or the Pacific. The unfortunate thing, there's also a comment letter that was submitted to the Army Corps of Engineers regarding the 10-year plan written by a researcher, Jenny Ross, who also wrote the greenhouse gas report. And I will forward that to everyone. I'm trying to write a summary because it's 40 pages and everybody doesn't have time to read that much. As far as the Long Range Planning Committee goes, it's not going very well, in my opinion, at this time. The committee is relying 100% on their consulting firm, Tetra Tech, to give them, they're considering a whole bunch of different plans, which, like Patrick said, are variations on old plans. But their estimate of water at the last meeting last week was that there would be 900,000 acre feet a year available going into the future from the Colorado River. And almost everyone in that meeting besides Tetra Tech took issue with that estimate, that it's very optimistic. That's how much water is flowing in right now. And many people were saying it could be, you know, down as low as 500,000 acre feet, which would be catastrophic. So I encourage people to watch the developments and keep speaking up. It's only been recently that the Long Range Planning Committee chair announced that there is going to be this new layer of evaluation on the part of the Army Corps of Engineers. So we're looking at another 3 years or more of waiting, which I really think is, you know, too long to have to wait. But those are my comments, and thank you everyone for your time.
Thank you very much, Chuck. Let's go back to committee members. And Oscar, you had your hand up earlier?
Yes. My question is, what makes the 3-year wait time for the study of the Army Corps of Engineers? I think we have all these past studies that we've all heard about, right? And I'm wondering if that can shorten the process somehow. It was really great, actually, to hear that the Army Corps of Engineers would now be involved because of that potential funding. And did you say it was up to 65% or 65%?
It's 65% federal match.
Okay. Yeah, so that's exciting that it could bring the funding. But, you know, is there any way that we can circumvent that 3-year waiting process?
Well, it's more than just a study, right? This is an underwriting, and it's an environmental document. So it's a full blown, when this work is done, it'll be shovel ready, so or near shovel ready. So it'll be ready for funding. So it will take time, and part of the complexity is going to be ferreting out some of these complex issues. One thing that was mentioned was that, you know, we're not just talking about the reduction in water, we're also talking about changes in water quality as a result of the implementation of all this stuff. So it's not just volume of water, it's the quality of water that are all affected by all of these decisions. And we need to come up with the project or projects, however it gets resolved, that can get done to transition the CN region to what it can sustainably be, which I think is the goal. This needs to be sustainable. One of the biggest challenges is going to be, how do we deal with the operations and maintenance of whatever gets finalized, whatever project finally gets approved? We can find money to build things and then not have the money to keep the lights on. So that's been an integral part of our conversation on the North Lake pilot demonstration project, is who's going to pay for that? And that's just 160 acres. We're going to have a lot more acres than that to deal with. So those issues are complicated and they'll get flushed out. Nobody, Oscar, to your point, nobody wants this done faster than me. I've got less time on this planet than you do. So I'd like to see it get done.
And so when we talk about Mexico, what are the incentives for Mexico to approve something like this? Has that been discussed in those meetings as well?
I am not personally involved in any of the importation projects. Frankly, the authority really has not been tip of the spear on any of that. We advocate for it, as Supervisor Perez says. You know, if we can help move something along, we have political capital that we can bring to bear. We have relationships that we can bring to bear. The technical side of some of this stuff is going to involve a lot of sophisticated individuals. There have been discussions. But candidly, I get mixed messages about the tone and temperament of the political leaders in Mexico. On the one hand, I hear they're interested. On the other hand, I hear that they're not. So it just needs to be flushed out at a high level. And I know that some have expressed an interest in getting engaged at that level. And to the extent the authority can be a facilitator in making that happen, we will do that. I'm involved with the International Boundary and Water Commission's Colorado River Forum. And to the extent that we have any opportunity to create those relationships, whatever happens, Mexico is our partner, right? And I think whatever happens to the Imperial and Coachella Valley, that's a strategic relationship. And so it needs to be cultivated.
Chuck wants to add a couple more comments. Can we bring Chuck back?
Sure.
Yeah, just quickly, I attended a meeting. Oscar was the chairman of it last week at COD, the future of water. And one of the guest speakers there was Wade Crowfoot, Joaquin Esquivel, the chair of the State Water Board, and Eduardo Garcia, the assemblyman. And at the end of the meeting, in response to my comments in support of ocean water import, Eduardo Garcia said that in recent months, he's been talking with officials in Mexico, and they're a lot more positive toward the idea of importing water from Sea of Cortez than they were 7 or 8 years ago. So I think, you know, people could talk to him and see what he's been hearing on that. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parker.
Well, like a lead balloon there, Patrick. I mean, the 65% match is intriguing to me. But it's just moving that carrot out even further. And, you know, it's like, figure out the plan.
Well, I appreciate that, Chair Evans. I think that what's even 65% of billions of dollars is always interesting to me. Mm-hmm. But what is as interesting is to have clarity. I think wherever we land on this, if we can say this is going to put us in a position where we can tell everybody this is what it's going to be like for the next 300 years, I think that's going to answer a lot of questions, take a lot of concern out of people's issues, and it's going to improve the opportunities throughout the valley. And I do believe that what's happening on the Colorado River is a critical problem, but it's an enormous opportunity. And I believe that as this moves forward, right now we don't know, right? There's a lot that we don't know, but we need to be prepared so that when we do know, we can operationalize all of our stakeholders in the community so that we can give voice to what we think we need in order to understand the impacts to us and what we expect as far as addressing those impacts. So I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to at least set the table for future conversations in that regard.
When it becomes somebody's personal issue, then it becomes their priority. And we're living with this somewhat as a personal issue in terms of our environment and the impacts, not only from a health standpoint, but obviously from an economic standpoint and you know, the future generations. And, you know, to Supervisor's point, it's you get to that point where you look at who needs to be living next to the Salton Sea that's making those decisions and those final funding decisions, and have them live what we live on various days, and seeing the potential and how many studies have been done and what's been happening and all the surplus money that's been provided for a number of either relevant or irrelevant reasons. There could be enormous impact, positive impact to this environment with the proper focus and plan. So appreciate you providing that update.
If I could just comment briefly on that, that's why it was so important to us when we advocated for the feasibility study through the WERDA plan to have the authority as the local sponsor.
Yeah,
because this is not going to get done from Sacramento. It's going to get done by giving local voice to it. And I believe that the state is sincere. I believe that they're hardworking, but they don't know like this community. They don't know La Quinta like Linda Evans knows La Quinta. Right. And they don't know Palm Desert like Gene in the standing knows Palm Desert. We have local elected officials at the authority level and in our stakeholder group that can better both inform and educate our community on what we need to do, what we need to do, and what we need to expect on a going forward basis.
Well, and as we have mentioned before, that all nine cities have passed resolutions to suggest that ocean water import is a viable option that needs to be considered. So you keep us posted on what more this commission, committee, and or our individual councils can continue to do to advocate for, because I believe that many of us feel like we continue to do that and understand the ramifications of what could result in, you know, our environment and economics with Salton Sea, but and feeling a little helpless in terms of action, but we continue to move forward.
Well, appreciate the spirit once again.
Always.
But eventually, I mean, don't get me wrong. I think Wade Crowfoot, this governor, has done much more than I would say last few, and especially this secretary. And I feel like that relationship is a really strong, positive, great relationship. However, I think sooner or later, folks, you know, it's going to be incumbent upon us to put our foot down. And we may have to go there. And what I mean by that is take legal action. I know people don't like to talk about that. I know we don't want to go there. But sometimes we have to write a letter of opposition to our own friends. It's not because we don't like them, or it's not because we don't get along with them, or because of their character. Maybe they're just on the wrong side of the policy. And so most times than not, we're on the right side. But on this one right here, we've waited decades and still. And that's a topic of discussion for another day. But nonetheless, though, I want to just plant that in your ear, because as you can probably tell in my voice, I'm starting to get a little sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Well, and I would say that Imperial County has the same sentiment. The tribe has the same sentiment. I'm confident that IID and CVWD are very sensitive to, you know, their decisions and how they affect the community. We are going to do everything we can to be ready to meet the needs of the community. We're not going to be able to do it alone. We're going to need partners like everybody on this, in this meeting, and every individual and every community group. And every environmental group to give voice to our concerns and make sure that we get it done right.
Thank you.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Very good. Thank you very much for your report. Yes. Okay. With that, we've got informational items. I don't know if you have any questions on anything there. Appreciate the
Did we lose our chair?
I think we did.
Yeah.
Vice Chair Ortiz or Chair Ortiz?
Oh, she's back.
Looks like Councilman Woods has a question.
You know, with the PACE program, can you just tell us what the ramifications are that are outlined in the staff report with them no longer funding homes, single family homes? What does that mean for the program? You know, is it an interest rate issue? Is it, you know, I'm just not clear. You know, it's an information item, but what happens to the program now?
If you wouldn't mind, in the interest of time, why don't we detail what some of those issues are and provide it on your next agenda packet?
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, public comments on non-agenda items. Do we have anybody that's expressed a desire to speak on non-agenda items?
Chair, we do not have any hands raised, and we have not received any written comments.
Very good. I'll go ahead and make the announcement for the next meeting. It'll be chaired by almost then Mayor Pro Tem Oscar Ortiz on Thursday, November 10th via Zoom at noon. And of course, our executive committee is at the end of this month on Monday, September 26th. Thank you for the opportunity to serve as chair, and I look forward to continuing to stay engaged and optimistic towards the efforts that we collectively do on this committee. So thank you so much. With that, The meeting is adjourned.
Thanks, Mayor. Thanks for your service.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Linda.